What exactly is capital structure? What is its importance for business? Austrian capital theory is critically important as a tool for business management, and a lot of its effectiveness depends on how you finance your business. Sergio Alberic is here to explain.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We are here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We're talking today about capital structure. We're fans of Austrian economics, as you all know, and Austrianism is the only school of economics that even includes a theory of capital for business. That's just one of the reasons why Austrian economics is economics for business. Capital is important not because of its physical form, as computers and buildings and machines, or even its financial form, but because of the economic role it plays. We talked in episode 87 with Matt McCaffrey about how to think of capital's role as generating a flow of customer revenues. And we talked about how capital must be flexible to be combined and recombined in changing structures to generate new flows amidst changing market conditions. This capital, this flow, often requires financing, since when a business is young, the revenue flows may be small, may even be less than costs. And at any growth stage, the cost of financing growth can be cash flow negative in short-run periods, and the cost of changing combinations to grow is also a cash user. All of these considerations incorporate time and change. What are my cash flows now? What will they be in the future? What investments and new combinations do I need to make now and in the future? How will those investment requirements change over time? What partners should I bring on now? What will they be like to work with in the future? How will capital partners' interests align with mine? How will we collaborate? Entrepreneurs think in time. They think in process, especially thinking several steps ahead into the future. They think in change. They think of capital as a changing flow over time. They think of capital as flexible and adaptive, especially in terms of combinations and recombinations. When a firm accepts external financial capital, what future conditions are being accepted? How will these conditions affect the unknowable future? Will they add to certain uncertainty or mitigate it? These are some of the practical considerations that enter into the minds of savvy entrepreneurs and the financial institutions and companies that provide them with capital to help them grow. Sergio Alberic runs one of those companies. Sergio is Spanish-Brazilian, and he's lived in Boston for the past 10 years. He's an entrepreneur and a financier. He's worked in investment banking, at a hedge fund, and an M&A firm. Then he acquired his first company at the age of 27. A branded furniture maker in Brazil. Since then, he's financed entrepreneurs in many different sectors and industries, from commercial real estate, internet marketing, cattle, legal techs, law firms, and jewelry. Whatever industry he's in, he always maintains focus on the importance of the capital structure in all of his investments. He has degrees from McKinsey University in Brazil and UC Berkeley in the US in finance and marketing. And for his master's, he attended the magnificent Professor Jesus Huerta de Soto's program at the Universidad Rey Juan Carlos in Madrid. He wrote his thesis on funding sources and the capital structure of businesses. Sergio, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Hunter, thank you very much.
Well, it's good to welcome you from Brazil today. And we're going to talk about capital structure for entrepreneurial firms, but do it in a very contemporary and real life as opposed to theoretical way. You're very focused as a venture capitalist on getting the capital structure right for every phase of the business journey from foundation through maturity. And we might refer to Lachman and Menger and Hayek and Coase a little bit as you do in your presentations that you make all over the world. But we're going to focus on the practical approach for people operating businesses. So let's give people a little bit of a background from you, Sergio. What is your story that brought you to your level of expertise that you have today about capital structure?
Well, Hunter, I think, like, perhaps differently from most kids when I was growing up, whenever I would do something bad or I would misbehave. So instead of being grounded at home or to lose my video game or something, my father would take me to his firm. And because I was good with numbers from early on, always my task where I would have to work would be with spreadsheets. So I started working I'm talking about mid eights, early, late eights. So I was working with Lotus 1-2-3. And yeah. What started as a punishment became like a passion of mine and was a great introduction to economic calculation and perhaps more than anything, the importance of deciding on how to fund projects, right? Because I was working with spreadsheets and figuring out the numbers, and inflation was huge in Brazil in the early 80s. So one of my tasks was to translate everything into US dollars. So it was the only way to make economic calculation, right? To assess profit and loss. But from the get-go, it became obvious that, hey, we have many interest projects, and we have those sorts of finance, and we have to match them. How can we finance project A or project B? So that was perhaps my point of entrance, the first thing that made me think about the structure of capital. And there is another story that might seem silly, but perhaps it was super particular to me, but most people has experienced something similar or has been aware of something similar. So I was 10 or 12. I cannot remember exactly. And a friend of my dad invited us, the whole family, to spend a long weekend at his summer house. And when we got there, Hunter was one of those huge houses, a $10, $15 million house right on the beach, beautiful place. But when we got there, even a small kid like me, I was 12, 10, I don't know, I could tell that there was something off. The garden was not well maintained. You would go inside and then some of the cabinets had some issues and perhaps the shower as well. I can't remember all the details, but I remember asking my dad what was going on. Hey, Pa, hey, that is something is off here. And I had been to his friend's house, and at his house, everything was super well kept. His wife was an interior designer. So they really cared about that, right? It was not they didn't care about that. And then my dad told me, hey, my friend has inherited this house a few years ago. And he inherited this house along with another 5 or 7 cousins. So it was one asset with 7 cousins. So nobody owned the house. So nobody was willing to invest money and time to keep the house. And that brings me, there is an old saying here in Brazil, and we say that, hey, a dog with 2 masters usually suffers of malnutrition. And that's capital structure at its core, right? Because we are talking about an asset or an animal here, but if nobody owns anything, who's going to keep that? Who's going to look after that? So that was perhaps the first steps that led me to finance and to pay attention to the capital structure. Then I was lucky enough to be in high school when I ran into Mises and Hayek and Rothbard. So I read some of them. I didn't get most of the things. And then when I started working, one of my first jobs, I managed to go work for an investment bank in Brazil. It was a Canadian-Brazilian bank. And I could see firsthand how important it was for companies to get a proper capital structure, proper sources of finance. Otherwise, they would not have flexibility to change business models. Otherwise, they would have issues with the shareholders fighting among each other. And I'm talking about late 90s. internet bubble. Everyone wanted to go digital at the time. Most of the world was still analog. So a lot of companies wanted to pivot, right? Even well-established companies. But sometimes they didn't have the capital structure to do that. So that was a huge school for me. And a few years later, actually, like the day before I turned 27, I acquired my first firm. And it was a furniture business in the southern part of Brazil, a mid-sized company with around 1,000 employees. And from that moment on, I think I never left private equity, venture capital, and I've been working that scene since then.
Well, good. That's a super background. I'm going to remember the idea of if your child misbehaves, send him off to his room and do economic calculation. That's a great story. But you've touched on the theme that I want to try and illustrate today, Sergio. And it's one of those difficult places where theory doesn't clearly translate into practice. Let me give you one of your quotes from Lachman. It says, "We live in a world of unexpected change. Hence, capital combinations will be ever-changing, will be dissolved, will be reformed. And in this activity, we find the real function of the entrepreneur." So I always struggle with that idea. What exactly do we mean by capital combinations, by changing them, dissolving them, and reforming them? How is that the function of the entrepreneur? Tell us about that in real life as you've perceived it.
Okay. So I think that quote addresses like one part of what is the function of the entrepreneur. I would define that the real function of the entrepreneur is to figure out how to profitably produce the goods and the services that will be delivered or that will facilitate value to consumers, right? So mm-hmm. The first part is to figure out how to produce that. And to figure out how to produce that, you need capital. You need capital in a sense that, and then we are not talking about like homogeneous capital, fungible goods, or just dollar signs. We are talking about computers. We are talking about machinery. We are talking about all the factors of production we need in order to produce whatever we want to produce, right? So we need to combine. We need to try out many different combinations. And there is no guide on how you should produce something. You have technical specifications, you have economic specifications, and you have to produce something that the consumer is going to value at the end, right? So I would say like that thing of trying out different combinations is trying to figure out the production process. And that's not static, right, Hunter? It's always dynamic. Maybe what works today doesn't work tomorrow. So we have to be trying out different combinations. Even if we succeeded yesterday, we have to try new combinations today. And that's the role of the entrepreneur.
Yeah, and you know, one of the fascinating things in Austrian economics for me is that point that you've got to think in time. So I've got my production factors today. I know what I'm producing, but I got to think to tomorrow. Are these still going to be the right combinations, the right production factors for tomorrow? And if they're not, how do I make that change? We're always going to be thinking ahead. Do you find that as part of the process?
Oh, an integral part of the process. As Huerta de Soto says all the time in every single one of his lessons, he said that like the future is not a to come, the future is a to do. So we, the entrepreneurs, anyone who is acting entrepreneurially, we are creating the future. Of course, we have to imagine what the future is going to be, what consumers want to do tomorrow, right? What they want to consume, but that's our role. Our role is to imagine that and to imagine how to produce that, right? There is always a technical problem as well and an economical problem behind. It's not only like, hey, people want to have flying cars tomorrow. Yeah, but can we produce that technically? Can we produce that economically? So that's the role of the entrepreneur, to put together those two sides of the equation, right? What consumers want or what the entrepreneur believes consumers want and what we can do technically and economically.
And then one of the points that you make in your presentation, Sergio, is that you've got to be thinking finance at the same time. You need finance to accumulate your capital. It could be debt or equity or some kind of hybrid of those things. But you've got to know what your finance options are in order to be able to manage that change going forward. So tell us about that part, thinking about the right finance for capital.
Okay. So I guess perhaps the first step is to understand the difference between equity and debt, right? So they're basically just different contractual arrangements between the person who is funding a firm or an investment project and the investment project or the person who is getting the money. And more or less instinctively, everyone knows the difference between equity and debt. But a simple way to summarize that would be like, that would be a fixed claim. So you know how much you're going to get every year. It doesn't depend on on how well the company is performing. Of course, the company can default. You have a risk there. But you have a fixed claim. You know you're going to get 3% a year or 4% a year. And you have a priority on cash flow. So first, the firm needs to return money to debt holders. And after that, if there is anything left, we're going to return to equity holders, right? That usually has a fixed maturity. So you know that loan I'm making to Hunter is going to expire next year or in 10 years from now, right? And that, by definition, doesn't give you access to control. You can have some covenants and some things you arrange ex ante, but you don't have control. You are not managing the company. While your equity, you have a residual claim, but you get a voting power. You can control your company, right? Of course, we have a bunch of instruments in the market that are hybrids, but perhaps we should focus only on plain vanilla equity and plain vanilla debt for our discussion today. And another layer that I bring to that discussion, another breakdown that I think we as both investors and entrepreneurs, we should pay attention to is whether we are raising funds, whether it's equity or debt, with many holders or with only a few holders, right? In the market, we say like it's a private placement. So by default, you are privately placing that contract, that the instrument with only a few people. And a public offer, it would be like making an IPO. So 100,000 people are going to buy your stock, or issuing a bond, right? You're issuing a bond, so many hedge funds, many private investors are going to be buying that. And I say that there is a categorical difference between few and many shareholders. It's hard to say which is the number for few and which is the number for many, right? If you have only a few holders of your debt or your equity, it's much easier to communicate. It's much easier to deal with them on a daily basis, right? And if you have a public offer, think about mass prediction. It cannot be a very tailored instrument. You need to have a minimum way of communicating your company, the risks, and whatever you want to do. So just the fact that you're going to have a few or you're going to have many holders of your debt or equity already implies a different arrangement, a different way of dealing with whoever is funding your company.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4BPod. That's MISES.org/E4BPod. And click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Yeah. So if we think of it through the lens of flexibility, I need to be flexible in my capital structure. I get the feeling the debt is going to make you less flexible because you've got this fixed commitment and they've got a first choice on your cash flow. It sounds like a few investors also tends towards less flexibility for the entrepreneur. Is that how you see it?
A few investors, you mean, would be less flexibility?
Or is it more flexibility?
So I would argue the other way around, that it's more flexibility. Okay. Because let's imagine we have a company, you and I, and Perbylon is investing in our company. And we want to completely pivot our investment. We just need to convince Per to do that. And let's say that we have 1,000 investors here. And we want to completely pivot. I don't know. We were in the restaurant business and now we want to have a nightclub. I don't know. Yeah. Right? And then we need to convince not all of them, but the majority of them. And the communication is much harder and much more costly. Like even in terms of flexibility, Per, we can call Per on the phone and Per is going to answer and then we're going to have a decision pretty quickly. If we have 1,000 people, we have to call a meeting and then we have to find a day that's going to be that. And then maybe it's going to happen only a month or two down the road. So communication is much slower. In terms of needing flexibility today and now, it's much easier to have a few holders and not a bunch of holders. And yeah, flexibility is a big point, a super important thing that we have to look for, especially when we are starting a business. But perhaps more than anything, what I try to do, I try to think into a means and framework in a way that the funding source, they're kind of fuel, the means to our ends. We have to try to match those assets and liabilities. And we can look at the funding sources as some sort of liabilities, right? You have some obligations towards these people. That's what I try to do most of the time. I try to figure out which is the proper mean for the proper end.
Yep, it always boils down to means and ends. It's always a good way to think about it, to the basics. So I am. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm trying to think about the future. I've got the different sources of finance figured out, but you say, hey, there are all kinds of other flexibilities or changes that you have to deal with, that your cash flow is going to change from time to time. There's different kinds of knowledge coming into your firm as you try different things. There's uncertainty that changes. Dynamics and statics are being rearranged. So one of the things you advise entrepreneurs is to think about these evolving states. They got to manage time, as we referred to. How can they do that? I made a reference when you and I were talking before about my friend Jackie Boland, who said when she started out, she didn't expect to be the CEO of a venture capital funded company. So how can you think of that in advance? How do you help people to think through the changes in their company?
I would say that perhaps like the whole point of getting the funding of the project right, the investment project that you are doing, whether it's a firm or just a product, is to allow the entrepreneur to focus on what he does best, right? On spending his energy, figuring out his production process and his clients, and not being trapped by the capital structure. So if you get the capital structure wrong, the entrepreneur is going to need to waste so much time dealing with, hey, I have to repay my debt, and I have a huge opportunity here to pivot or perhaps to reinvest something, but I cannot because I have to repay that. So you get the foundation right, and it's going to allow the entrepreneur to be all the time reinventing himself. And I like what you said, like you have to be thinking ahead all the time. So you have to be aware that perhaps the way that knowledge is spread out within your prediction process is going to change through time. Think about like a startup or even on the stage before it's a startup, when it's only a project in our minds, in the mind of the entrepreneur, right? So that knowledge is super tacit. It's super exclusive to him. So if that person leaves the business, There is no knowledge there. The business is over. And if we were talking about a mature company, if the lead entrepreneur leaves the company, much of the knowledge needed to conduct the activities of the company is already ingrained into the processes, into the culture of the company. You already have the suppliers, you already have the employees, you already have the capital combinations, the combinations of the factors of production. So what I try to do and what I tell people that they should look at is all the time to try to understand where they are in terms of knowledge, in terms of dynamic and the static efficiency, and where they are headed to. Some scenarios are going to be better suited for equity. Some scenarios are going to be better suited for debt. Some scenarios are going to be better suited for many holders and another for only a few holders. So that's in a nutshell what I try to do all the time.
Yeah. There's another dimension also that I think the economic world is starting to understand a lot better, and that's relationships. And that's part of your asset base, if you like, good relationships. And we're finding Absolutely. Now in contract theory, Sergio, this kind of flexibility is starting to be built in. The parties are recognizing that contracts shouldn't be rigid, that there should be possibilities of rearranging the nature of the relationship if the environment changes. Is that happening in debt and equity contracts as well, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. They are contractual instruments, right, Hunter? So, of course, if you buy stocks on the stock exchange, it's going to be like it's a very static instrument that you have. And it's static and very, very standard because needs to please 100,000 shareholders. You cannot tailor that exclusively to people. But more and more, we start to see some instruments that bring some elements of the dynamic world, allow to change. Think about like the most common instruments that people have to invest in startups, which are convertible loans. One of the things that it brings to the table is the fact that you don't need to discuss valuation right now. You're going to discuss valuation in the future. So you make easier the initial arrangement, and you make possible that situation is going to adjust to a new reality in the future. So, yeah. We try to do that all the time in most of the contracts.
So perhaps it would be useful, as far as you can, to give an example of how this flexibility with capital and the changing combinations of capital can change over these phases of development of the firm. You kind of overlay the types of finance that you can use with the stage of development. Is there a good way to illustrate that flow that we can help people with, yes, Sergio?
Yes, absolutely, Hunter, absolutely. So the way I try to look at three major blocks, and I try to understand, how are the factors of production combined, right? We already discussed a little bit of that. So are they proven relationships, or I'm still trying to figure that out, right? So when we are still trying to figure that out, we are at the startup stage. Then at the expansion stage, when the company starts to grow, you already have some combinations that are working and you are expanding, trying to figure out new combinations. Then at the growth stage, basically you are doing more of the same all the time. And when the company is mature, you already have proven combinations, right? And then we can even have decline when those combinations are not working anymore. And then the second layer of analysis that I try to do is I try to look at the cash flows. I try to look at whether the company is generating positive operating cash flows, or which part of the company is draining resource. Is it operations, or is it investments, or is it finance? Right? At the startup mode, there is basically zero cash flow in operations, right? Maybe we have pre-OPEX there and it's draining some cash, but that pre-OPEX is more or less analogous to investment, right? So you can even allocate in investment cash flow. And you have a huge cash flow coming in investment. Some people are pouring money, whether it's debt or equity, people are pouring money there. And when you have a mature business, they tend to be cash cows, right? They are generating a lot of cash. So the operating cash flow is big. It's where the value is. And usually at the financing side, you're already paying dividends. So it's negative. And then on the investment side, maybe you're reinvesting depreciation. You try to maintain the same combinations you had before. So you maintain your strengths. And then the third layer I try to look, we are starting a business. We are passionate about our businesses. But at the end of the day, we want returns, right? We want profit. Mm-hmm. But it's not profit on a P&L statement. We want returns on our equity, on the effort we are putting there, on an investment we shareholders are making. And at the early stages, all the returns, they are so ahead in the future. And it's a matter of getting the combinations right, getting to produce a product that's going to please the consumers. So I am really worried about future cash flows, generating those future cash flows. I don't care about the cost of financing that. Meanwhile, when I have a mature company, it's not that I am expanding my options. I am what I am at this moment. So I start to pay much more attention to my cost of equity. The cash flows are in the present, my cost of capital in general. So at that stage, that starts to be more attractive, right? Cost that tends to be cheaper than equity. And I can leverage my business as well. So I can increase my return on equity, which matters at the end. So I would say that those are the three characteristics of your business, the three layers you have to look on every single time. And you have to relate that to the characteristics of that equity, many holders and only a few holders.
Yeah. That dynamic view indicates why venture capital is very attractive at the early stage, because venture capitalists tend to be tolerant of a lack of cash flow, in fact, negative cash flow. They celebrate it, right? Burn rates, they talk about. It's the celebration of negative cash flow. So that explains the value of venture capital, but it becomes very expensive equity when it converts or when the company grows, right? So you got to balance that current against the future stage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's not because venture capital is the right source of finance for a company, that it is the right source of finance to get so much venture capital money that the entrepreneur, the main leaders of the project, they're not going to have any equity left. I would say that even on the side of the entrepreneurs, that's a very bad choice. The entrepreneurs, I mean, on the side of the investor, that's a very bad choice. Because let's say, Hunter, you and Mark Packer, you decide to start a business. It's an education business. And Mark has, he can produce that amazing product. And you, Hunter, you know how to market the product, takes it to the market. And I'm going to provide the funding for you guys, right? The first thing is that I know nothing about the business. I can bring some knowledge to the business on the financial side and everything, but who's going to try out the different combinations of factors of production? It's going to be you and Mark. Who's going to have a hand on the market? It's going to be you and Mark, right? So I need to have you guys, first of all, in control of the company. You guys have to have the agility to change things from one day to the other to better provide services to your customers. And on the other side as well, I need to keep you guys very motivated. You guys need to be running towards something. You're going to make a lot of money there. So you need to have a lot of equity. So a thing that happens quite often in VC we see that sometimes some entrepreneurs, they become writing so many convertible loans out there. Then when you convert everything, you're left with 3% of the equity. So that's a recipe for failure.
Yeah.
Right? They have nothing more to stay there. And if they leave, there is no company. Because I am investing in you and in Mark to make that business happen. So yeah, I would say it's private equity in a sense that it's not public. It's not many people investing. It's a few holders. And it's equity. But it's not in a way that's going to dilute completely the lead entrepreneurs.
Right. And keep them motivated is the key, right? They got to see the end.
Motivated and with the ability to control the process. Because yeah. We investors, we don't know the details of your business on a daily basis.
The other element of this flexibility and thinking ahead to the future, Sergio, that you've enlightened me on certainly is about organizational innovation, that we shouldn't just be thinking about the capital structure and the financing, but also the organizational issues, what the literature calls principal agent conflicts. And you've discussed that in the structures of limited liability corporations and partnerships and organization specific kinds of things. Can you just tell us about how to think about that for a second?
Absolutely, Hunter. I think this framework of thinking about the means ends were the source of finance or means, and then the ends is whatever we entrepreneurs want to produce. I think this framework can be used for any kind of investment project, right? Think about law firms, for example. And most of them, they usually operate as a cooperative of lawyers, and they basically are sharing only back office costs and rental and the IT guy and the finance person, but they are not cohesive companies, right? And usually they are like a nest of snakes where politics plays a big role and everything, and they are not very agile and they are very conservative in the way they conduct their business, not their politics. But and I would say that many times it goes this way because they decide that they're going to have 100 partners and every partner is going to have 1% of the company, right? So they are not sharing a common project. So one of the companies I'm involved in, Batista Luz Advogados, like one of the things that make us different is because we have real equity. Like we have a leadership. Decision-making is super quick. Like we have someone who's going to lose a lot of money if the wrong decisions are made, mm-hmm. right? So we have the agility to conduct that law firm as a business and not as a cooperative of people just sharing costs and other things. So yeah, I would say you can use it for anything. Like perhaps another example I can give you, like one of my investments right now is a jewelry business, which it's a super risk business because it's still a startup, right? And I need the lead entrepreneur. I need her to be running the show 24/7. I need her to be ultra committed to the product, right? At the same time, mm-hmm. like, oh, she's doing that 24/7. She needs some kind of compensation, right? She cannot live out of fresh air. So she needs to pay her bills and everything. So she needs a salary. She needs control over the whole process. What do I know about jewelry? Like I like gold. I like gold as an investment, but jewelry, I mean, I like to give to my wife and my sister and my mom, but I know basically nothing about jewelry, right? And she needs to have like a huge upside. So she's going to be motivated and she's going to be working 24/7. Right? She needs to be in charge of most things. So how do I structure my investment there? Is it debt or equity the right instrument for me? How much equity? Mm-hmm. Do I get control? I would say no, I do not get control, even though I'm making most of the investments because I need her to be running the show. She cannot call me in the middle of the afternoon and asking, hey, what do you think about those pictures, this new catalog or that new design? Mm-hmm. Right? I know nothing. So without Sheeder, like there is no firm, no nothing. So I need to have equity along with her. I have to be aligned with her, but she needs to have control. So which instrument I have in this case? Like I have a convertible loan, but because the investment is so risky, and in this case, I have a very liquid asset inside the company, which is that is like the inventory, mm-hmm. right? All the money that we're spending marketing, it goes away, it fades away, right? But all the money that we're investing in the inventory, it's very tangible. We can touch them and we know the value of that, perhaps not the jewelry value of that, but the raw material value of that. We can very easily price that. So what I do here, I have a very different contract where I own the inventory. So it reduces my risk and allows me to not have a majority stake in the firm. And I need to not have a majority stake in the firm because I need the lead entrepreneur to run the show. I'm basically buying her capacity. And even though we are still on the initial projects of the initial stage of the project, like we have already doubled our revenues from last year, and last year we doubled from the year before. So we are getting the right results. And I think in part because the structure of capital is not blocking the entrepreneur, is not creating any hurdles to the entrepreneur.
Well, let's get Austrian for a second, Sergio. One of the implications of what you're talking about here is what Mark and Per, since you've mentioned them, talk about subjectivity and entrepreneurship, i.e. that all of these questions are very human questions. They're flexible. They're about futures we don't know about. They're not optimal equations. And the tradition of economists and you say financiers tends to be optimum equations. And you made a great presentation at AERC 2021 recently about that problem in CAPM. So tell us about that. Tell us the difference between managing by equations and managing by this kind of flexibility that you're talking about.
On the financial front, I think like neoclassical finance, like they neglect the means and the framework where the funding sources are the means and the ends are whatever the entrepreneurs want to do. And I think they do that because they focus almost exclusively on the idea of a risk return maximizing investor that works with objective probabilities. And when you start to think that finance is just a set of equations, like the subjectivity of choice, the entrepreneurial judgment, everything goes out of the window. And we're talking about Lachman, and Lachman is perhaps an extreme subjectivist. But when we are talking about the combinations of the factors of prediction, everything is happening in my mind, in the mind of the entrepreneur. And when we are assessing what the company has, that's a subjective valuation. I might be wrong. I might think that they have some combination that's very stable and that combination is not very stable. And that's one of the reasons why I use the expression that, the proper source of capital and not the optimal source of capital, because it's not about math, right? It is all about exercising entrepreneurial judgment, and figuring out your source of capital is pure judgment. Here we have a guideline. We have some ideas on how you could structure your thoughts around that, but it's not a stick measure that's the only way to go, right? So I would say the problem with mainstream finance and neoclassical finance in general are the same issues that affect neoclassical economics in general, is the over-reliance on the homo economicus.
Your mutual friend, I'm overstating the case of friend, but we both know of Huerta de Soto, and he has a wonderful way of doing those side-by-side comparisons, the Austrian economics view and
those tables are awesome. Those tables are awesome.
And we can publish one of those, but it sounds like you could do the same thing for finance. I mean, finance thinking and the proper source of capital, the optimum source of capital based on sometime return calculation, and sources of capital based on uncertainty and humanity and thinking about subjectivity. Maybe we'll attempt that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And Huerta had a huge influence on me, even the way I present my papers and the tables, the grids I build. I got some of that from Huerta's tables and everything. Absolutely, Hunter. I think as we discussed it many times, that, like, there are so many fields, so many subjects that Austrian economics can help the entrepreneur. And I think perhaps finance is a neglected field. Like, we have the proper structure of capital. We understand subjectivity. We understand that the value is at the head of the consumers. We talk all the time about economic calculation. Like, I feel that's a field where we should be leading the discussion and not like have one or two people discussing here and there financial theory. I know that many Austrians talk about investing, right? On which stage of the business cycle we are. But here we are talking about like developing tools to help the entrepreneur to exercise better judgment, to better act, to better serve the consumers. So I would say that's the role of finance.
Professor David Rapp, when he was on this podcast, Sergio, he talked about accounting in that way. Accounting is a means for the entrepreneur to achieve business ends, and therefore you should use it as a means. It's not a set of inflexible rules that you have to follow. It's the proper way to use accounting as a means to achieve your end. So the Austrian view of means and ends is applicable everywhere, I think.
Oh yeah, I agree 100% with Dave Durap, and I would say that Huerta de Soto would agree with him as well. Mm-hmm. And I would say that finance is only two things. Perhaps I'm simplifying way too much, but among that set of tools that we can provide to the entrepreneur, I would break it down into two of them. One would be economic calculation. What would be the things you discussed with David Rapp in that episode, like how we assess profit and loss? How do we know that we are doing the best allocation of resource, right? That's one of the jobs of finance. And I would say most of the case, mainstream finance gets this one okay. It's not so bad. Mm-hmm. But where they fail miserably, I would say it would be on the second part, which is the thing that we have been discussing, is to help the entrepreneur decide on the proper source of finance. For me, that's finance, those two things, and those two things only.
Good. Well, I think you've helped entrepreneurs tremendously today in the advice that you've provided and the insights that you've provided, Sergio. So thank you very much. We'll try to do a good summary of this, and maybe you and I can work on one of those side-by-side tables that we can use as an exhibit. We'll try it.
It would be wonderful, Hunter. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you, Sergio.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit HunterHastings.com.